Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, historian Maurice Berman talks about American decline and what we can possibly do about it. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm back in Hartford after 5 days out of town. 3,000 miles out of town, in fact. I went to Seattle last week for my firstborn son's first wedding. Speaking of firsts, this was the first I had flown in 16 years, since before 9/11/2001. Apparently, in recent years, the federal goons have toned down the post-9/11 airport security fascism. Suitcases can be checked at the curb once again, and the security screening was quick. I didn't see any nuns or 90-year-old amputees in wheelchairs getting strip-searched. That's progress of a sort. I suspect the government realized they could keep up the terrorist threat hysteria for only so many years, in the absence of any actual terrorist threat. And I suspect the airline business didn't want nuns strip-searched any more than the general public did. A rare example of the public good and corporate profits actually coinciding. Seattle seems to be a vital and viable city. It has good public transportation, several thriving industries. It has lots of little stores, nice little restaurants, plenty of bookstores, independent artisans, several colleges and universities, and some good non-commercial radio, too. I returned to Hartford, which has none of the above, except good radio. Days before we arrived, Seattle had legalized recreational marijuana use. I'm pleased to report that disaster did not strike. The city is still standing. The trains are still running. In fact, nobody seemed even to notice, let alone care. What people were noticing was the good weather. They actually had 5 days in a row without rain, and with a high of 80 degrees. Happens all the time here in New England, but the Seattle locals were astounded. Everyone was talking about it. Marijuana is old hat there, I guess, but 5 sunny days in a row is alarming. Still, it's good to be back home in my quiet and uncrowded town east of Hartford. Back on my bicycle. Back motorcycling the back roads of rural Connecticut. And back to my trusty microphone as I piece together installment number 333 of New World Notes. I was planning to assemble a hodgepodge. Leftover parts of other shows that were left on the cutting room floor and never broadcast. Good stuff, all of it. There just wasn't time for it in earlier half-hour shows. But one long segment really reached out to me, and today we'll hear just that. It's a question-and-answer session with historian Maurice Berman. It followed a talk Berman gave that we broadcast several months back. Berman argues that capitalist industrial civilization as we know it is collapsing. The world financial system and economies are collapsing. Democracy is collapsing. The oceans are collapsing. We're running out of the cheap fuel on which industrial civilization depends, and we have severely damaged the ecosystem. The system, as we know it, is simply unable to continue. Something different will replace it. But what? What rough beast slouches towards Bethlehem to be born? As Yeats asked. Maurice Berman doesn't know either, but he's not expecting utopia. Okay, in his own way, Berman is saying what several other thoughtful people have been saying. saying on this show. Not only Yates, but people like journalist Chris Hedges, like economist Richard Wolff, like Richard Heinberg from the Post Carbon Institute. So, in his question and answer session, Berman explores these themes some more. Maybe it was Seattle that made Berman really resonate for me. Today, Seattle looks like a vital, viable, prosperous city. But is it? And for how much longer? A century ago, Hartford was a vital, prosperous city. Now it's a sleepy backwater. 100 years ago, Camden, New Jersey was a vital, prosperous city. Now it's a ruin. When I was a teenager, Detroit was a vital, prosperous city. Now it's largely a ruin. How vital and prosperous will Seattle be 50 years from now, when the rest of America has collapsed? When gasoline reaches $100 a gallon, who is going to be buying those Boeing airplanes that Seattle now makes? Or flying in them coast to coast? When nobody can afford a computer, let alone a smartphone, who will buy all that software Seattle makes and sells? When the oceans warm another 5 degrees, what are Seattle's fish markets going to sell in place of fish? Here is historian Morris Berman.
So if you folks have any questions or comments, I'd be glad to entertain them.
To what extent do you see democracy as the problem, and would you advocate something like the benevolent dictator?
Yeah, it really is a good question, because democracy, in a certain sense, past a certain point, gets into a crisis. Aristotle pointed this out, and de Tocqueville mentioned that democracy can only work if the population is fairly intelligent, and we don't have that. So it's coming apart at the seams. I'm not particularly an advocate of taking the system and somehow fixing it, because I don't think history works that way. So even if there were a benevolent dictator running the show, I mean, in limited sense, it might work. For example, during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt turned to General Motors and Ford and so on and said, you're not manufacturing cars anymore. For the next 3 years, you're manufacturing tanks and materiel. Then we'll talk about cars. And I don't want to hear any baloney about it either. You know, I mean, that was benevolent dictatorship, and we needed to do that. In a limited sense, that might be okay. But in terms of reorganizing a whole civilization, it's quite impossible. It's quite impossible. And so in terms of scenarios for social change, honestly, I think this just has to play out, democracy and all. It simply has to play out. At the end of that, the situation will be so dysfunctional that all the alternative experiments that have been going on with alternative energy, alternative currencies, and so on, and some countries have quite a few. Spain has like 325 experiments of this nature. Those things will become more and more attractive. The analogy I would make is, to take the title from Johann Hausinger, the waning of the Middle Ages. We are now in the waning of the modern ages. That's what's happening. And what Hausinger pointed out was that period, which lasted in that case about 200 years, was a very depressed one psychologically, because people lost their moorings, and that's what's happening today. It won't take 200 years in our case, but things are just too speeded up now. But we are entering a period of people being completely dislocated and just doing more of the same. That's all they know how to do, you know? So I think it will eventually play out. I call this a dual process, that as capitalism comes apart, what you have is the emergence of these alternative experiments. And more, they will become the new socioeconomic formation. But this is just a guess. I don't have a crystal ball. And when I went to graduate school, it was in history rather than prophecy. So, you know, I mean, I'm just giving the most likely scenario I can think of, because I don't think that the notion of grasping the situation and actively doing something about it can be done. I just don't think that's possible. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. Okay. The title of that book, it's an edited book by Thomas Lewis. The title of the book is A General Theory of Love. And he writes, a good deal of modern American culture is an extended experiment in the effects of depriving people of what they crave most. In other words, what we are channeled into by this system is substitute satisfaction. Because what human beings want is what they've always wanted. Community, friendship, sex, interesting things to think about, safety. Those things are permanent. And what this system does is it takes those away and says, here's a cell phone. Here's lip gloss. Here's television. It gives you stuff that basically is and it says you'll be happy with that. And generally people aren't on some level. And that's part of the crisis, really. Yes, sir.
And the next question asked whether the West could adapt any lessons from Eastern cultures.
I mean, the West is what it is. You know, I mean, it's not China and it's not Japan. Last year, I spent more than 6 weeks in Japan. This is a society with a lot of problems, as I'm sure you know. But it also has some things that are absolutely remarkable about it. At the time of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, there was a situation in which 40 workers were trapped in a single room overnight. It was freezing cold. And there was one cup of ramen to go around. There was no fighting. There was no discussion about it. They just passed it. Everybody took a spoonful. And that's how they survived that night. One commentator on this said, I can't imagine another nation in which such a thing would take place. Certainly it wouldn't be the United States. They'd be clawing each other's eyes out for the ramen. So there are things that we can learn, but whether we could adapt them, I don't know. What I do know from my study of history is that the midwife is always force. When you have no choice, that's when you do something different. If we're going to move to Buddhist economics, it's because there is no other choice. So then the Japanese will look very good. You know, all of a sudden it'll be very attractive and we'll be in praise of shadows. That's what we'll be doing. We'll make a virtue out of necessity. But that we could adopt another system in a real way, I don't think is very likely. You know, I can't remember his name. Soki An, I think, came to the United States in 1945. He was the first Buddhist monk to arrive in the United States, set up a center, and try to teach Americans Buddhism. And after a while, he said, you know, it's like taking a plant and sticking it next to a rock and expecting the thing to take root. It didn't work. What happened with the flirtation with Buddhism in the United States in the 60s and 70s was it got filtered through the American competitive system. So basically, you had Zen. I mean, I sat Zazen in San Francisco for 2 years with Richard Baker. Meanwhile, Baker was sleeping with all the female disciples and had to have a Mercedes to drive around in, you know. And that culture of American Buddhism was, my guru is better than your guru, you know. That's not the idea of Buddhism. But you see what I mean? It comes through an American filter and it comes out something different. So the possibility, I think, of seriously integrating something like that into our system can't open up as long as it's a trend or it's chic or it's fetish. It can only open up when there is no other choice, you know. But I think that day will come. Yeah, that's a great question. What's happened over the last 10 years is a very strange thing in media ecology. Hard copy press and television is largely worthless. They are not telling you what is going on. The function of the New York Times is to make a professional, middle class, comfortable, and feel that everything's okay. It's not all the news that it's fit to print. It's all the news that fits our views. That's the true motto of the New York Times. And so when you read the editorial, I mean, I can write you, you just name the subject, and I can write you a Wall Street Journal editorial with my eyes closed. I can use their phrases. Believe me, it takes no talent at all. They just grind them out like this. There is no real information in these sources. So where are they? They're largely in online websites like Common Dreams, Truthdig, Truthout, Alternet, Counterpunch, and a whole series of websites that have emerged in the last 10 or 15 years in which the journalists are not regurgitating what they're supposed to do, but they actually do investigative journalism and then report it, which is what newspapers did in the United States in the 19th century, part of the 20th. So we now have a two-tiered kind of situation where if you want to feel that basically the United States is on the right track and everything's okay, then you read the Post and the Times and so on. If you want to understand what's actually happening in the culture, you have to go to those alternative websites. The problem is that most Americans are unaware that they exist. I mean, their readership or whatever, you know, visualship, whatever you want to call it, is vanishingly small. And this creates a problem, precisely at Plato's Cave, that the number of people who are actually interested in analysis and the nature of the American narrative and how it's coming apart and so on and so forth, maybe in a nation of 315 million people, maybe that amounts to 200,000. Well, that 200,000 is not going to change anything. All they can do is watch the lemmings go off the cliff. Still, you know, it's entertaining. You might as well watch. What the heck? You got something better to do? I mean, I have to tell you that I have been absolutely amazed at the reporting that goes on at these alternative websites. They take my breath away. Whereas the New York Times is sitting around and picking its nose, these people go out in the field, they interview people, they come back with the stories, and they write them up. It's real journalism. New York Times isn't doing real journalism. So the question is, if enough people then start to become aware of that, then they might engage in those alternative experiments. That could change prevent the disaster, but it could make an alternative socioeconomic formation more likely to occur and perhaps more intelligently. Sir?
Your report is largely pessimistic. And I'm going to try and squeeze a little optimism out of you.
What the heck? Many brave men have tried. Do it.
What about our youth? You're talking about old people like ourselves, people that run the New York Times, run the big corporations. Do you feel that the new digital media is producing a new kind of mindset among our young people? Talk about the digital natives. Is there any hope that they can change this system before the tank goes over the cliff?
No, there is no hope they can. The problem with the youth is that the nature of this technology has largely colonized their minds. The studies now of the damage that this technology does to the brain, to synaptic connections and all that, is quite heavy. Check out the footnotes in Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, for example.
That's a shallow book.
Yeah, but he has good footnotes. And the footnotes refer to research that's been done by lots of people that's very, very good. And what you now have is, for example, every time there's an introduction of a new technology or a new methodology, like multitasking, everybody goes nuts. Oh, we'll all multitask. 10 years later, it turned out that multitasking slows the brain down. And actually, one industrial expert calculated that in a single year, it cost American industry, multitasking, it cost American industry more than $600 billion. There's a problem with that, the nature of digital technology that changes the mind. Books that are read that are print are read in a very different way than books that are read on screens. This has been established too. People who read screens scan, and people who read books sit and think about what's on the page. This is a big difference. Young people are not interested. I can't make generalization for all, but it seems to me that an awful lot are very excited about the new digital technologies. It's new, it's cool, it's hip, and so on, and it's making them dumber and dumber. So I don't see a lot of possibilities in those directions. You know, a friend of mine who's a journalist gave a talk on U.S. foreign policy at Occupy Wall Street in Washington a couple years ago, and he said that his audience consisted of about 60 people, and he looked around, and there were only two people in that audience that were under 60 years of age, as far as he could determine. In other words, there is not a thirst, except for a very small percentage, there's not a thirst for the type of analysis that used to go on when I was in high school, let alone college. There's just not that ability anymore. And frankly, as my academic career wound down and the years went by toward the end, I was quite glad to get out. As my academic career wound up, I saw in the papers that were being turned in less and less of an ability to write coherently, to spell, and above all, to understand the difference between opinion and argument. They just didn't get it. If they felt something, it was true. That's all they knew. If I said, well, what's the evidence for this? They would just stare at me. What do you mean? This is not a likely source, I think. I mean, where it's going to come from is an interesting question, but I don't think it will be a question of age. It's a question of exposure and sensibility and other things. Age, I don't think, is a predictor right now of avant-garde, myself.
Someone asks about the movement in favor of relocalizing in America, such as consuming local food, generating power locally, and so on. Can this help?
Yeah, I think, thank you, I think we've got to do it. My general feeling is that we will repeat the Roman experience in which the revival, which was the urban revival of the 10th century, took place in Northern Europe and not in Rome. In other words, if there's a revival, I don't think it's going to happen on American soil. However, that being said, one of my closest friends, Joel Magnuson, just published a book called The Approaching Great Transformation, in which he went around the United States and he interviewed people that were doing these alternative experiments. And it's a very perceptive book because he identifies the ones that talk trendy, holistic stuff, but basically it's just for profit. You know, it's sort of like, you know, Thomas Friedman or Al Gore Green, you know, while hundreds of millions of dollars are pouring into their bank accounts, you know, corporate green. But he did identify a few experiments that were serious, that were not for profit, not for expanding the economy, but for serving the community. And so that struck me, I mean, it just struck me as a wonderful project to undertake, to at least search out to see what there are. It's pitifully small compared to Europe, but it's there. It's there, and it might leave a trace. Not all of these experiments have to go the way of Ben and Jerry's. Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Look, as far as Elul goes and technological determinism, I mean, I always took the position with McLuhan that technology was not value neutral, that was ridiculous. That if you introduce the technology to a culture, you introduce the culture's values to that culture, I mean, where it came from, and that was going to inoculate and infect, basically, that culture. Now, whether this can be generalized or not, I don't know. It goes back to this gentleman's question earlier. I had quite a shock when I was in Japan last year and discovered that although the Japanese text all the time, they sit on subways and text and so on, they don't talk on their phones in public. That was quite a shock. In fact, if you ride the Tokyo subway, there's an image of a cell phone and superimposed on it, in English, block capitals, the word off. The Japanese are very sensitive about bothering other people in public. They're very considerate of how the other person is receiving whatever's happening. I remember being in a cafe and a woman's cell phone rang. She immediately took it out, also took out a small towel, put it over the mouthpiece and over her mouth and talked in such a low way that nobody could hear. The idea is that you don't bother other people. In the United States, it's very common that I'll be in a restaurant 3 feet away, a woman is yelling into her cell phone about the details of her gallbladder operation, which I really wanted to know. We are not considerate, and the technology basically makes us just more obnoxious. In Japan, the culture of group psychology, which is very strong there, is actually able to contain that technology. So this was the first time I had it right in my face that maybe technological determinism is not so deterministic. That's number one. As far as Wallerstein goes, I can't think of how we're not going to go through a period of darkness and anarchy. I can't imagine how. You don't get a new socioeconomic formation for free. That's not how history works. You have to pay for it. And I can't imagine that there will not be the rise of not only in our anarchist movements, but secessionist movements, which actually I see as a good thing, but also this kind of minority scapegoating, especially of Hispanics that we now see with, you know, the border and so on. Because as things get chaotic and most people don't understand what's going on, they find targets for their anxiety. So I think we're headed for a rough time. In addition, just recently, this is kind of interesting because about a year ago, I wrote Chris Hedges about the fact that if there's going to be a real severe ecological crunch, there's going to be mass migrations within the United States and a lot of panic as the ether grid or the electrical grid breaks down and so on. And that my guess was that the Pentagon, this is like a year ago, that the Pentagon had in place scenarios for what to do to control populations. Chris wrote back and he said, I have no doubt that that's true. So I wrote back and I said, frankly, I'm guessing that they're doing actual training exercises in the Nevada desert right now. Do you think he can find out about it? He said, I'll try. Well, just a few weeks ago, there was a report released. I think Glenn Greenwald wrote the article. Again, it was an alternate or something like this. But it's basically about what the Pentagon has been doing, including training exercises in the Nevada desert to get ready for crowd and riot control. In other words, what happens when the system breaks down? There's going to be the army on every street corner in the United States. You can count on it. And so I think that kind of thing lies in our future. But I don't think it's necessarily a permanent condition. I mean, we will have to go through a pretty rocky time, and I expect that's going to happen. But it's not going to be the end of history, you know.
Historian Morris Berman. I like the guy a lot, and I like his recent book, Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline. Check it out at that bastion of left-wing socialism, your friendly neighborhood public library. That's Why America Failed, by Morris Berman. And if you want to listen to Berman some more, I'll post some links to shows featuring him on our website. And that is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks to Robin Upton and unwelcome guests for the audio we heard today. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust urging illegitimi non-carborundum, support your local farmer, put some oil on that bicycle chain, and please come back again next week. Ciao!